Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from North Rim Bank, supporting news, educational, and cultural programming across the state on Alaska Public Media.
We are simply asking individuals to confirm, because we received information from a verified source, that these individuals were not U.S. citizens.
Alaska elections officials defend putting thousands of registered voters on an inactive list. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, July 22nd. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, Alaska's largest native health care provider reaches a $400 million settlement with the federal government.
To be sure, a significant amount of money is owed the tribes.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska Public Media is all about community. Wear your community on your sleeve with the purchase of branded clothes and collectibles from our online store. Visit alaskapublic.org/shop.
The Alaska Division of Elections has moved thousands of registered voters to its inactive list due to suspicion that they are not citizens. State Director of Elections Carol Beecher acknowledged the allegations might be based on very old data. She told legislators at a hearing in Anchorage today that her agency sent 3,500 letters to Alaskans saying the Division of Motor Vehicles had flagged them as possible non-citizens. Beecher portrayed this as a routine exercise that doesn't take away anyone's right to vote. She says people who got the letter can just check a box to indicate they are citizens or call or email the division.
We are simply asking individuals to confirm, because we received information from a verified source, that these individuals were not U.S. citizens.
Some of the voters who received the letter went online to check their voter registration and were alarmed to find they had already been removed. Some contacted their legislators, including Representative Andrew Gray, a Democrat from Anchorage, who raised it with Beecher at the hearing. Two legislators said they were concerned the letters might have been part of a federal initiative. President Trump has been trying to assert more influence over state elections, warning of fraud that elections experts say is unfounded. Beecher said this is not related to the federal government. Every 3 months, she said, the division checks its voter list against the Division of Motor Vehicles data, looking for people who might have said they were not citizens when they got their driver's licenses. This time, she said, the list that they got back was especially long.
So we understand that some of this is probably very old data where the individuals did not contact DMV, have not updated that they are a naturalized citizen. I believe that people probably don't realize that all of these governmental entities don't necessarily talk to each other.
She said voters who don't respond will remain on the inactive list, but she said they still can vote a questioned ballot. While Gray and other legislators sounded uneasy about the letters their constituents got, Republican Representative Kevin McCabe from Big Lake defended the division's actions, saying it's the agency's job to ensure the voter rolls are clean and correct. Alaska's main native healthcare organization is set to receive a $400 million settlement from the federal government for unpaid expenses to provide medical services. The U.S. Department of Justice announced the settlement Tuesday. Aliona Niden with the Alaska Desk reports.
The Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium filed a lawsuit in 2021 claiming that the federal government did not fully compensate the organization for administrative costs over 7 years of providing medical services. The settlement follows several U.S. Supreme Court decisions in favor of tribal health contractors like the consortium. Lloyd Miller is a tribal attorney who handled 3 cases involving costs that the government had refused to pay.
To be sure, a significant amount of money is owed the tribes. And the latest settlement you heard about is just one of many settlements that have been achieved throughout the United States over the last 2 years.
The Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium provides health services in clinics throughout the state and at the Alaska Native Medical Center in Anchorage. The organization also runs rural infrastructure projects in villages, including improving water and sewer systems. The consortium entered an agreement with the federal government under the Indian Self-Determination and Education Assistance Act. Under that agreement, the consortium is responsible for providing health care that the federal government would otherwise provide through agencies like the Indian Health Service. The consortium said in its court complaint that the government failed to reimburse administrative costs for healthcare services between 2014 and 2022, with the exception of 1 year. Natasha Singh is president and CEO of the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium. She said in a prepared statement that the settlement helps make sure that, quote, resources accurately reflect the true cost of operating a complex tribal health system and advancing self-determination in healthcare, end quote. Singh said the details of the settlement are still being finalized, but it helps the consortium to expand their services for Alaska Native people. Tribal attorney Miller says this and other cases follow a 2024 U.S. Supreme Court decision that the federal government owed money to the Carlos Apache and Northern Arapaho tribes in Arizona and Wyoming.
When the court held that those two tribes had been underpaid, the court was saying that every tribe in the United States that has a contract with the Indian Health Service has been underpaid.
Miller says many tribes have filed or reactivated litigations with the Indian Health Service in the last 2 years. In Anchorage, I'm Alona Naiden.
The U.S. Coast Guard tracked Chinese vessels traveling through a section of international waters in the Bering Sea recently in the first such instance this year. The Coast Guard said in a statement Friday that its personnel monitored the Shui Long last week while the Chinese research ship moved through the U.S. exclusive economic zone. That's an area about 200 nautical miles offshore where the U.S. has jurisdiction over natural resources. The vessel was headed for the Arctic and another China-flagged research vessel, the Shui Long 2, according to the Coast Guard. Foreign ships are allowed to transit through the area, but would need prior permission from the U.S. to conduct marine science research. They would also be required to share information they collected. The Coast Guard cutter Monroe monitored the two research ships, part of what the Coast Guard calls Operation Frontier Sentinel, making sure they followed international regulations. The military has seen increased foreign activity in the Arctic in recent years and expects that to continue this summer. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a longtime Thlinkit teacher reflects on a lifetime of learning the language.
Don't be afraid to make the mistakes and have fun with the language. It's in you. It's always been in you.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska Public Media is now partnering with an Alaskan auction service so a helpful local team can get the biggest return for the least hassle should you decide to donate your vehicle. Learn more at alaskapublic.org/vehicle.
Human remains were discovered inside a chest freezer at a Juneau residence on Sunday. That's according to a news release from the Juneau Police Department Tuesday afternoon. Police received a report from a person who was cleaning out the home of a dead family member in Lemon Creek when they discovered the remains in a chest freezer Sunday night. The freezer was in a shed on the property. In an interview, Juneau Deputy Police Chief Craig Campbell said police are trying to figure out what happened. He says it's a suspicious death and investigators are not ruling out homicide.
I can only speak for Juneau, but very unusual. It's not something I've seen or heard of before.
Campbell says based on the body's appearance, police investigators believe the frozen remains are of an adult male related to the person who previously lived there. Police sent the body to the state medical examiner's office and are awaiting an autopsy report to confirm the person's identity and cause of death. He says police have a preliminary identification and he doesn't think the person had ever been reported missing to the Juneau Police Department. Campbell says it's too early in the investigation to release the name of any individuals who might be involved or further details regarding the remains.
I think that's the biggest kind of unknown is when did they get put in the freezer? That's going to help pinpoint our investigation and do that as well as collecting evidence to see who might have done this.
Campbell says the department plans to provide updates of the investigation to the public as more information becomes available. The Anchorage Assembly took the rare step Tuesday night of censuring a fellow member over what the Alaska Public Offices Commission ruled was an improper use of campaign funds for travel. APOC ruled in June that East Anchorage Assembly member George Martinez violated campaign finance laws when he used campaign funds to pay for a flight from Alaska to Florida last December. At their meeting Tuesday night, Assembly members took up a resolution to censure Martinez for the campaign violations. That's a formal expression of the body's disapproval. Some Assembly members, like South Anchorage's Zach Johnson, pointed to Martinez's actions when APOC commissioners questioned him. In their ruling, commissioners described Martinez as evasive and his testimony as not credible. Johnson says Martinez's response to AIPOC's investigation could compromise the public's trust in the Anchorage Assembly.
I think the crux of this is that the testimony offered by the member to AIPOC was not credible. It's not that there was an AIPOC violation, it's that testimony piece.
The Assembly voted 8-3 to censure Martinez. In response to the AIPOC ruling, some Assembly members have also scrutinized Martinez's use of city funds for travel he took in his capacity as an Assembly member. Assembly members debated a resolution that would direct the municipal attorney to investigate Martinez's travel. Martinez told Assembly members Tuesday he has followed standard municipal processes when making travel and per diem requests. Assembly members debated the resolution on whether to investigate Martinez's use of city funds until midnight, the mandated deadline in city code for an Assembly meeting. The resolution was then bumped to the next Assembly meeting scheduled for August 4th. The Alaska Department of Fish and Game has announced an emergency permit hunt for Alaska residents to harvest muskoxen stranded on an island in the Bering Sea. The hunt opened today and closes on December 1st. The tiny island, known locally as Paumute Island, is located less than half a mile from Nunavak Island's southern coast and roughly 40 miles from the Kuskokwim Delta mainland. According to the state, at least 5 muskoxen are stranded on the island. There is no source of fresh water on the island, forage is limited, and their survival is unlikely. Hunters can apply for a permit by visiting hunt.alaska.gov. It's not the first time the state has opened hunting for muskoxen stranded on islands or ice floes, having done so in 2017, 2020, and 2021. Well, Bristol Bay set netting used to be dominated by women. When the fisheries permit system started in the 70s, it had the highest rate of women permit holders in the state. But that's changed over the decades, and one researcher is digging into the decline and why it isn't happening anywhere else. KDLG's Jesse Sheldon reports.
June Ingram has fished the same family set net site in Ekuk for over 60 years. Her grandfather first came to Bristol Bay as a winter watchman for a cannery.
My grandfather, who was from Denmark, came to Bristol Bay, and he was a winter watchman for a cannery. And then he came to Ekuk in 1939 and staked this property, this site.
Even though it was her grandfather who first staked the site, Ingram says things looked a little different when he first showed up.
He said there were all women on the beach, but he was the first man.
Ingram says set netting sites in Bristol Bay have traditionally been operated by women, which allowed them to multitask, fishing both commercially and for their families.
The reason why women stayed on the shore was to also subsist, not only put up fish, smoked fish, but also to pick the greens and herbs and berries as the seasons came along.
But the number of women set netters in Bristol Bay is declining. In the mid-70s, when limited entry permits were first issued, 57% of set net permits were allocated to women. Today, only 34% are. Amy Burnett Cross is a postdoc fellow in economics at the University of Alaska Anchorage, researching women's participation in the labor force. She spent much of the last year crunching the numbers on set net permit holders in Bristol Bay to better understand why this decline is happening.
The other piece that we are interested in as economists is to think more broadly about why we're seeing something so different in the trend than we're seeing in almost every other high-wage occupation in the economy.
She says women's participation in most other high-wage industries has increased. Cross's research is still underway, but she has two primary hypotheses. First, as more high-paying economic opportunities open up for women elsewhere, they become more likely to exit.
As the economy develops within Bristol Bay and as local women move to Anchorage and other parts of Alaska, they have access to opportunities in jobs where they're earning higher wages or their employer is not allowing them to come back and fish during fishing season. That kind of pull away from the fishery is accelerating women's decline.
The other factor is the decline of shore-based buyers in Bristol Bay.
if they no longer have someone to sell fish to on the shore, then they're forced to now deliver on a tender or find another buyer.
She says a lot of women set netters are caregiving while fishing and don't have the flexibility to leave their site. Cross found that when limited entry permits were implemented in the 70s, Bristol Bay had the highest rate of women permit holders anywhere in the state, by a landslide. Cross thinks one federal regulation from 1937 may have helped. The rule required 2 years of residency in Bristol Bay to participate in the setnet fishery. She says this regulation protected local access rights for setnet sites. Cross also found that women retain Bristol Bay setnet permits for much longer than men, often for 30 to 40 years, even as markets change.
So women are more likely to retain permits within the family when permit prices are high, meaning that they're less likely to sell to the highest bidder. They're more likely to probably to be giving their permits to a family member.
For June Ingram in Ikuk, sharing the setnet tradition with her family is at the core of her fishing.
We enjoy life. We show our children. We bring them closer together, our families.
For the many Alaskans concerned about the migration of permits to out-of-state hands, Cross says it's vital to examine each fishery individually and to look at the specific pressures women in a fishery face, including Bristol Bay setnetters. In Dillingham, I'm Jesse Sheldon.
An alternative newspaper based in Anchorage is coming back from the dead. The Anchorage Press's new owners announced last month they were restarting the paper after its previous owners, Wick Communications, ceased publication in 2022. The new owners, Vary de Souvereau and Nat Herz, are familiar faces in Alaska nonprofit leadership and journalism, respectively. Seattle-based Noisy Creek, owner of Alt Weekly's The Stranger and the Portland Mercury, rounds out that ownership group. Herz is a former reporter at the Anchorage Daily News and here at Alaska Public Media, and he also owns and operates the Northern Journal. But he says the rebooted Anchorage Press will be decidedly different, and the hope is to get back to its mid-90s roots.
There's a really long history of like really cool stuff that the press used to do. And we, as part of this acquisition, we got the hard copy archive. And I was just sort of going through, like, they've got amazing, you know, misconnections and personal ads. They've got a police blotter. They've got Susie Buchanan, who was a longtime staff member, dressing up as a member of the band Kiss and going to a Kiss concert. And there's that whole kind of like fun, edgy alt vibe. But then there's also like, I think, a tradition of journalism that went on in the Anchorage Press that I think we're also really hoping to carry on, investigative work, like just, you know, accountability and entrepreneurial reporting. And then I also think like we really see the press historically, and our vision for the future is that it's a place to have writers articulate their own voice and identity in a way that maybe isn't as easy to do in sort of more mainstream media. And we're definitely not here to knock mainstream media. It's just different, right? And I think, you know, we want some new voices, some different ways of, you know, people voicing their lives and realities and experiences.
I have to admit, I did work there. I started there 20 years ago, straight out of college, first professional job in journalism. So there's that disclaimer. But I did wonder, the news business can be rough. And obviously in our time in journalism, newspapers have suffered greatly. Quite a few of them have gone under. So what makes this different now? I mean, when you see other newspapers folding and you're, you know, starting up another one, how does that work?
Yeah, this is an annoyingly good question. Yeah, why would anyone restart and invest money in a dead tree newspaper, which is what we're doing? We're going to be publishing in print once a month. You know, I'm not going to say we have a silver bullet and the panacea to all of the media business's problems, but I think we are bringing like a new business model to this, which combines a sophisticated and savvy business partner based out of Seattle, a business called Noisy Creek that owns a number of other alt weeklies across the country. They've been really successful in tapping into like a network of national philanthropies that's supporting their work. We are also going to sell subscriptions and sell memberships. We want to, you know, potentially have other revenue sources through like live events. you know, digital ads, and then we're going to, you know, sell ads for our print paper. And I can't tell you that we know that this is going to work, but what we do know is that this is similar to the way that Noisy Creek has run their other businesses, and that they are not losing money.
How close are we to having a printed paper? And I say that as somebody who remembers, you know, going to cafes and even bars around Anchorage, and you would see people reading the actual printed Anchorage Press. When will we see that?
Well, one of the really fun parts is, like, we really see this as almost as like a community trust, where we're kind of rebuilding this institution with help and support from literally dozens. We have more than 130 folks who have expressed interest in working with us or volunteering, and there are already folks who are like, yeah, we want to be the ones to like drive the piles of newspapers around to places like Middleway Cafe. We just picked up a wire rack from Wildman's in Cooper Landing. And so I probably should not give you the exact target date that we are going to launch our print product, because I would hate to disappoint folks, but I think I can safely say 100% before the end of 26, and I think as soon as September, you may see us hit newsstands.
That was Alaska journalist Nat Herz, now the co-owner of the Anchorage Press, along with Vary DeSouvero and Seattle-based Noisy Creek. Keekla Ish Lyle James has been learning and teaching the Tlingit language for more than two decades. His passion grew through attending classes and leading songs. He lives in Juneau and has taught more than 1,000 students, emphasizing the importance of making mistakes and maintaining a non-judgmental environment. He encourages others to try learning the language regardless of initial fears. KTOO's Elin Chappelle recently spent some time with James and has this audio postcard.
It's exciting for me to see my students outside of classrooms. It makes me happy when I see them out in the community and they say, hey, Keekla'ish, or wasi'ati, wasi'tu'ati. So just asking me general questions. My name is Keekla'ish. I am Kaguantan, Eagle Wolf from Kuna. And I come from the Mud Bay area, clan-wise. I was born in Sitka, and I was raised in Huna and in Cake. Growing up in Huna, I went to Huna schools. Got to hear and learn from a lot of the elders in that community, like, for instance, Jenny Lindoff, and even my great-grandmother, Elsie Pratt. And they spoke only Tlingit to me. I grew up around language, but I didn't start learning Tlingit until I was 23 years old, learning how to speak it myself. I attended a kuik here in Juneau, and the family that was hosting the kuik knew I was learning how to lead the songs, so they called me up and to lead some of the songs for them. And after that, I actually met my wife at the time, and she took me to one of her language classes with Florence Mark Shakley. That was my hook, was attending the class and seeing how much fun they were having with the language. At my GED graduation, and the principal of Yakuske Takahedi was at my graduation, and I introduced myself in the language, what I knew from attending Florence's class. And right afterward, she asked me, are you looking for a job? She asked me if I would be interested in teaching Tlingit language. And I told her straight up, I don't speak it fluently. I am a student in the language. And she said, you're perfect. You are going to make our students feel comfortable learning the language with you. And that's what encouraged me to do language full time. I try to figure out what the students are interested in. And if I find something that aligns with what the students enjoy, then I try to incorporate it in the language as much as possible.
if the students are not afraid of playing a game in the language, then they are learning at the same time without the fear of making the mistakes. And I think that's the biggest thing, is making sure the students are not judged when they make their mistakes, because shoot, I make mistakes all the time. I want my students to come back and take over my classes and make it bigger and better than what I've left behind. Have courage. Go out there and try it. Whether it be in Tlingit, whether it be in Khadkil, Haida language, Tsmagich, the Tsimshian language, go out there and enjoy it. Don't be afraid to make the mistakes and have fun with the language. It's in you. It's always been in you.
That was Kikla Ish Lyle James speaking about his journey in learning and teaching the Tlingit language in that piece by Elin Chappell in Juneau. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Aliona Niden and Wesley Early in Anchorage, Maggie Nelson in Unalaska, Clarice Larson and Elin Chappell in Juneau, Evan Erickson in Bethel and Jesse Sheldon in Dillingham. Our audio engineer tonight is Dave Waldron, Kirsten Dobroth is our producer, and I'm Casey Grove. Good night.